The Laura Murphy Show, episode 34.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. After a brief hiatus, which was unplanned, and I take full responsibility for that. I had a lot of traveling, and then I was sick there for a few days. But now we're back. Carlos, you're back with us as well, I assume?
I am. And, you know, I was going to ask you, seems like you were in the heart of all the action in Houston. Were you in Houston during the Super Bowl?
I had an apartment there, but no, I actually was in Lubbock, and I watched the Super Bowl from the house of one of my colleagues here at the Free Market Institute. And I just want the people at my apartment complex in Houston to know that I did not try to rent my room out through Airbnb, even though I think I probably could have gotten $1,000 at least for the weekend.
I bet you could.
I would like to say it's because I'm a good little rule follower, and in my lease, I think it says that I'm not allowed to do that, but also it was because I was lazy and didn't really want to go through the hassle of setting that up. But to answer your question, no, I was, even though I have a place in Houston, I was not actually there. I watched it from a different spot. And what a game it was. I do want to say, though, for people using superlatives to describe this, people from upstate New York, which is where I'm from, we all know that the comeback game in terms of postseason involving Houston was the 1993 Buffalo Bills' amazing performance coming back from a 32-point deficit to win the game. So that's the comeback game as far as Buffalo Bills fans are concerned.
You know, I wasn't even going to watch it. I've gotten to the point where, you know, big-time football, it just doesn't attract me like it used to, even though I got two sons that put on the pads when they were 5 years old and played all the way through college. For some reason, it's lost its appeal, you know, for me. But I did watch it, and it was one heck of a game. It really was.
Yeah, and what's really funny is I don't know if you're even on Twitter, Carlos, but there were a lot of people who made it political on both sides. You know, I'm not saying one side or the other, but because as you may know, I guess Tom Brady's personal friends with Trump, and so people, when they were getting blown out, you know, the Patriots are getting blown out, people were sending out like messages, hey, if you're friends with Donald Trump, this is what happens to you, like when it was like 28-3 or something. And then of course you can imagine what happened with the Trump people did once it turned around. So it was an awkward night for many people who were calling it prematurely, to be sure.
Right. Yeah, there was all kinds of stuff going on like that. At the gym this morning, the big focal point seemed to be Gaga, that there was a little too much loose skin around her navel for some reason for a rock star of her caliber. But that seems to be a big topic of discussion at the gym this morning. And then the other one was this business about the owner of the Patriots, claiming that Putin stole his Super Bowl ring. Did you hear about that?
No. Are you making a joke, or is that a joke?
No, it's for real. Apparently, what's this guy's name? I think his name is Robert Kraft. He's the owner, you know, of the Patriots. And he was telling Fox News during the Super Bowl that, because he is friends with Donald Trump. And as you mentioned, so is Tom Brady. And I think even the coach for the Patriots is friends with Tom Trump. And so he was saying, maybe Trump will get my Super Bowl ring back. And it was the 205 Super Bowl ring. He was in Russia visiting, and he had an opportunity to meet Putin. Putin noticed the ring, the Super Bowl ring on his finger, and made some comment like, good grief, you could kill a man with that thing. And so he takes it off his finger and gives it to Putin, but he never gives it back. He just walked away with it. I mean, that ring's like $25,000, but apparently Kraft was saying that, yeah, I mean, before I knew it, a bunch of KGB people surrounded Putin. He walked off with my ring. And so he wants Trump to get it back.
That sounds like a Simpsons episode when Homer's got like a $1 million bill or something, and he goes and gives it to the Castro still in charge of Cuba and takes it. So I might be getting the details wrong, but that's why I thought you were making a joke there, just because a lot of people too were doing the making it political and saying, Falcons blew their lead the way Hillary blew hers, and then, you know, oh, let's blame it on Putin. It must be Putin's fault that they lost. So we're talking about Trump, and this is what we're going to do now for this episode, folks, is sort of just give a potpourri of our reactions. Like I said, some time has passed since our previous episode, and just mention various things. We're trying to stick to mostly economic stuff, but some of these other things, you know, bleed over into issues of civil liberties as well, which we don't shy away from here at the Laura Murphy Show. Also, I want to mention that much of what we're going to be talking about is going to be in the Laura Murphy Report in much more depth in future issues of that, particularly as I look more into this stuff about the tariffs and so on. So why don't we just, I guess, start with that, Carlos. One of the big things recently has been this issue of foreign trade and tax reform in Mexico. So here, let me just give a little taste of this because it gets really complicated really fast. And so the first thing I should mention is there's a distinction between what they were talking about is imposing a 20% charge on Mexican imports to, quote, pay for the wall. And that's not the same thing that the congressional Republicans are working on, which you might have heard is referred to as like a border adjustment tax or a destination-based cash flow tax, or some people might say, oh, yeah, they're considering putting in a VAT, a VAT, a value-added tax. So those are all different things, and I just want to, first of all, give you our listeners that lay of the land, that what the Republicans are working on, it's in the context of broad-based tax reform. And there is this concern, and this goes back, I've been mentioning this every time we bring up the topic here, Carlos, that Trump's advisors, in one of the white papers they released in terms of Trump's economic plan, they said that, hey, look, the U.S. is at a disadvantage vis-a-vis its major trading partners, particularly the ones in Europe and Japan, because those countries, those governments rely on a value-added tax for a lot of their revenue, whereas in the U.S., at the federal level, they have a corporate income tax. And also, you know, personal income tax on the things you would get as a shareholder and so on. And that has implications. The fact that the U.S. system relies on income tax and not on a VAT, whereas European companies rely on a VAT subject to a VAT, that has major implications, especially if what you're worried about is outsourcing. If you're worried about U.S. companies that sell products to U.S. consumers, the fact that the U.S. relies on an income tax and Europe relies on a VAT, that gives a perverse incentive. And again, this is all in the white paper that Trump's advisors, Peter Navarro and Wilbur Ross, put out. And their concern was a U.S. company that is going to make a product and then sell it to the U.S. consumer has to pay income tax to Washington, D.C. If it instead wants to try to export to European market, it still pays income tax to Washington, D.C. It's not like the firm gets a rebate on its income taxes because, oh, wait, you know, you exported those, all right? On the other hand, if a European firm wants to export a good into the U.S. market, Washington doesn't charge them an income tax, right? The U.S., you know, they don't have jurisdiction over the income from some foreign corporation, so they don't get to charge them a corporate income tax. And on the other hand, U.S. products going into Europe, when they enter those markets, they get hit with the full value of the VAT coming in. And then, but conversely, European exports, you know, so a company that's in Germany, let's say, that, you know, makes a product, they've been paying all along the value added tax at each stage of production. But then if they sell it to the U.S., they get a rebate from the German government for that VAT tax. And so it was just, you know, they were walking through and saying, look at the perverse incentives here. If you were a U.S. company, you have a huge tax reason to relocate, you know, to move your operations over to Europe, let's say, and then sell back into the U.S. market, because now you're avoiding U.S. income taxes and you're not getting hit with any of the VAT stuff because you get rebated when you export. And what's funny is lots of economists were saying how stupid these guys were. And, oh, my gosh, they don't know the first thing. Everybody knows a VAT has no impact on a tariff on international competitiveness. And I finally got around to, I had the time to go look up, you know, some of the literature here. And there's this classic paper by Paul Krugman and Martin Feldstein. And they said the exact same thing. They said that, yeah, a VAT by itself. So if all countries around the world had a VAT, that doesn't interfere with international trade, that a VAT is neutral because of those border adjustments. But they said if there's a country that has an income tax, then yeah, that is penalizing the exports of that country, at least until exchange rates might adjust. So anyway, that was a long way of me reminding people of the position here, but it's just funny that when I finally got time to go dive into the literature to really get into it, it turns out that what Trump's advisors were saying in that white paper is largely correct. And so that's part of the context here, Carlos, of this congressional tax reform. You know, the idea being, hey, can we reform the system? We have a really high corporate income tax rate. You know, can we do something about that so it's not penalizing our exports as much? And so that's the spirit. That's one of the rationales behind it. And I don't think I should go more into that here because it gets really complicated. However, a totally separate thing is this issue of the wall and who's going to pay for it. And because the Mexican government kept saying, well, we're not paying for that, what are you talking about? And then Sean Spicer and Trump, in separate, you know, comments, at least for a period, made it sound like, oh, well, ultimately the way we're going to make Mexico pay for it is we'll slap a 20% surcharge on imports coming in from Mexico into the U.S. And that's the way we're going to make them pay for it. So notice that is not the same thing as, you know, having broad-based reform that applies, you know, generally to everything. This is a specific targeted tariff just against Mexican imports. And so there's a lot wrong with that. I'll say one thing and then I'll turn it over to you, Carlos, is you make sure you realize it's not the case that by slapping a tariff on goods, you're making the exporting country pay for it. On the other hand, don't make the opposite mistake. I saw a lot of Trump's critics saying, oh, no, actually, that's going to make us pay for it. You know, avocado's not going to get a lot more expensive. And and they were making it sound like prices in the U.S. to consumers were going to rise by 20%. And that would be the full stop. And that's the end of the story. So I joked that, wow, people hate Trump so much that even progressives now understand trying to tax businesses actually hurts consumers. That's like the first time in my life I've ever seen them acknowledge that, is in the context of Trump. But it's actually not correct that it gets more complicated when the government levies a tax, even if it applies it formally to the company and the company's the one giving the funds to the government. That's not really the issue because prices can adjust. All right. So what would happen in practice would be a combination of things, that the price that the Mexican firms could charge to Americans would drop such that when you slap the 20% surcharge on it, then, you know, the Americans, yes, are paying more out of pocket for the same amount of imports, so they're being hurt, but also the Mexican exporters are getting less after tax when all things are, you know, when the dust settles, so they're being hurt also. And so it's an empirical question that has to do with what economists call the elasticities of supply and demand to figure out, you know, who bears what fraction of the burden. But it's again, so the people, you know, Trump and Spicer, who are making it sound like, don't worry, Mexico's paying all for it, that's wrong. But the flip side's also wrong. It's not true that just U.S. consumers pay for it and it doesn't hurt the Mexican exporters. It hurts them. And then it's just an empirical question is who does it hurt more? But the point is it hurts both sides. All right, I've been talking a lot, Carlos. Why don't I turn over to you?
All right. Well, if we're talking about things having to do with Trump, I'll pick one out here. There's one particular area that Trump has announced he's going to go in and do a complete overhaul in. And it's the Department of Labor fiduciary rule that went into effect or the beginnings of it, went into effect about a year ago. And it has really caused an enormous upheaval in the, you know, financial services industry, affecting, you know, brokerage firms, affecting life insurance companies, annuity companies, and all the huge number of financial professionals that are out there in the United States. And this has to do with a law that was passed back in 1974, the ERISA Act, which is has a long name to it. It's the Employment Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. And this has to do with the retirement savings of, you know, millions of Americans. And it's a huge amount of money, somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 trillion that's involved here. And so the Department of Labor sort of has oversight over ERISA. And where the controversy was coming in is that you have, under ERISA and under the Department of Labor, a designation known as a fiduciary, a person is supposed to be doing everything in the on behalf of the client first, thinking of them first. And so there was this whole area about that perhaps maybe retirees or people that, you know, had money in these retirement accounts maybe were being charged too much, or they were not being treated equitably. And as I began to look into that particular act, I realized that the area they were really focusing on was the individual retirement accounts, which for some reason do not fall under the oversight of the fiduciaries within the ERISA Act. So that sort of opened the door for a lot of financial professionals to be able to do business with members of the general public and move their retirement accounts into some other products, financial products, that not that they did anything wrong for the individual clients, but, you know, they had maybe perhaps larger commissions on them. And ERISA or the Department of Labor was thinking that maybe those individuals also needed to fall under this fiduciary designation. So it caused an enormous upheaval in the financial services industry. And most firms in the industry really hate the ruling and, you know, can't believe that they're really doing this. And it's supposed to go into effect this coming April 2017. Well, now that Trump became president, he's saying no to that ruling. And so obviously a lot of financial firms, of people in the financial services industry were overjoyed that Trump was going to step in and tear this thing up. Now, the latest on it is that what he's really asking for is not, he's not really going to do away with it. What he's really asking for is there be some sort of a study, a much more careful study done on the ruling. And apparently Trump is wanting to know if this is in fact in the best interest of the retirees out there, people that have money in these retirement accounts. Are they getting enough options? Another thing he's worried about is this ruling going to create any major disruptions or dislocations, you know, within the retirement services industry? That's another thing he wants this thing reviewed. And then the last thing why he wants the review done is because he's wanting to know if it's going to create now an increase in litigation, you know, with a lot of these individuals, you know, not providing the right kind of advice. And now that the general public will have more reason to sue a financial professional than they would have had before. And so these are the main things that Trump is very interested in, more or less an investor protection kind of thing. And so the bottom line on it is that it's, you know, as we're hearing the news as of today, it's not so much that he's going to tear up the act, you know, the ruling, but he's having it reviewed. So he's putting in his key people in there, you know, his Secretary of the Treasury, I guess his name is Numick, Stephen Numick, to look into it. And so at best, he's going to wind up delaying this rule from going into you know, being enacted in April. He's going to probably delay it for about 6 months.
Okay. Yeah. And there's a lot of what is coming out is of that form where they're saying stuff that, you know, seems to be reasonable in the sense of, you know, somebody from a free market perspective and the Trump administration just like, hey, we're going to review these things just to assess their impact and make sure it's not imposing unnecessary hardships and things like that. So it is hard at this early stage to really say, you know, is it really going to be fundamental reform and improvement, or are they just kind of saying that to curry favor with people who want to hear that? But I will say, I mean, a lot of the stuff that Trump is doing on areas where I'm, you know, my areas of expertise, it's pretty surprising. It's pretty radical in the sense that the moves they're making are things that, you know, would not have happened under a Hillary Clinton administration, to be sure. But even beyond that, just a typical run-of-the-mill Republican administration. So in particular, I'm thinking of things on energy issues where people are on the left are very alarmed. Oh, my gosh, look at the stuff Trump's doing. And I can see why they would be, because, you know, he is drawing on advisors and, you know, people who I think are, you know, pretty strong views. I agree with them. So that's kind of what I mean, that the fact that the people that are, you know, giving input into the Trump administration's policies regarding energy and environmental issues insofar as they affect the energy sector. You know, I'm very pleasantly surprised by some of the people that he's asking for input from, that it's, I wouldn't have thought that would be possible before. Let me also just mention, you know, this issue of the wall. We talked about that in terms of the economics. I do just want to go on record as saying that to me, that's a bad idea. Whether you know, think that it's a good idea in terms of limiting the flow of illegal immigration, I think that, you know, building a big wall is just not a great idea, in the sense that if the U.S. is ever going to be like a truly dystopian police state, one necessary component of that is that people wouldn't be able just to leave, right? Like, you think about the Berlin Wall, you know, what was the function of that? It was to keep people in. It wasn't to keep people out, because people were trying to escape. So when the government makes moves like this, because we've already seen financially, this was clearly happening under the Obama administration for sure, various measures, you know, tax harmonization and things like that, FATCA, for people in the financial sector know what that is, various measures that were being put in place, cooperation among the U.S. and other governments to make it that people leaving would have a hard time taking their money with them, their assets with them. And so if all of a sudden they start massive construction on this huge physical barrier cutting off the southern border, again, that what alarms me is, uh-oh, so that's making it that much harder if, you know, if things really do deteriorate in terms of civil liberties and so on down the road, that, you know, it's that's one avenue. In other words, a wall that is enough to keep out unwanted illegal immigrants is also one that can keep in people who are just trying to leave. And you could say, well, come on, give me a break. That's not going to happen in the next 4 to 8 years. Okay, but if that's what your answer is, remember, you're just being as naive, I think, as the liberal progressives, the leftists, who wanted all of these great expansive powers for the federal government when they thought Hillary Clinton was going to be president, right? Oh, yeah, health insurance, sure, yeah, okay, all this stuff. And now, now that Trump's the president, they're all of a sudden realizing, huh, maybe having a president with all this power with executive orders and so on, maybe that wasn't a good idea. And so I'm saying, if you're, you know, on the conservative right, don't you make the opposite mistake and just think of it in terms of, oh, the next 4 to 8 years with Trump in charge, would I like there to be this massive wall? Oh, yeah, that sounds good. But remember, somebody you might detest is going to be the president at some point. And do you want it there to be, you know, these massive barriers? I guess it would have to be on the north also to really be effective. So anyway, I just am cautioning people to have a long-term perspective And if, you know, you're a fan of 1984 and stuff like that, well, the government building a giant wall should make you, you know, a little bit concerned about the future. So I guess, Carl, should we, since I brought that up, should we talk about the executive order on, you know, the immigration status from those seven countries and refugees and so forth?
Yeah, we can. Sure.
Okay. Well, so here, I have a few remarks and then I'm curious to hear your thoughts, Carlos, as you know, you are an immigrant yourself coming from Mexico when you were younger. So, you know, I'm not really allowed to talk on this stuff because I'm, you know, a fount of privilege in many demographic respects. But let me just say, and then this is the problem with the way that I think it's backfiring, the way the media and all these celebrities and stuff are. Their strategy with Trump is to absolutely demonize everything, to say, you know, somebody who's in one of his advisors, it's not enough now to say the guy's a racist. Now he's got to be a white supremacist or white nationalist. You know, when he may not even be a racist, just certain things he said might have been like bad jokes and poor taste or something. And I think same thing here by calling it like a Muslim ban when, well, no, it's not a Muslim ban. All right. And then, it's obviously only applying to certain countries. And then I've seen people say, oh, and I guess how did he pick these countries? I guess it's countries where he doesn't have business interests when, no, my understanding is those seven countries were under the Obama administration singled out as being risk for terrorism. And maybe we should look at an overhaul of our visa program or whatever that, you know, this was not just something coming out of Trump's, you know, out of thin air that Trump cooked up. This, you know, there were precedents built in here. So my point is just demonizing and then, you know, riding and so forth on this when it's not at all clear that these people were so concerned about Obama's secret kill list and things like that. So it's, again, I want to be clear. It's not that I'm saying, oh, yeah, Trump can do whatever he wants as long as it's kind of the same stuff Obama did. No, that's not what I'm saying. But when people are flipping out and using, you know, saying this is Hitler and how can anyone just sit there and do nothing when that's what they did when Obama was there, it makes it difficult. So I think, and I mean this with all sincerity, when people want to, you know, object to stuff Trump's doing, you know, be a little bit more judicious in the use of your terms, because look, a lot of people liked Trump. You know, you could say he lost popular vote, but he did win the Electoral College, and that's not because everybody despised him. He has a lot of support. And when people, you know, flip out and use over-the-top rhetoric and so on, and mischaracterize what something is, then it feeds into Trump's claims that this is all just fake news. And these people are just out to get me and they're lying. And so Trump's supporters are going to tune it out. Like, oh yeah, I've heard all this stuff before. So I would encourage people to try to be a little bit, you know, tone down the overblown rhetoric and actually focus more on what it is the issue is and, you know, why is this a problem? Just to give you one example that I'm not just speaking in generalities. There was some reporter at the airport, I think it was at JFK or something, you know, where they're having these demonstrations, let them in. And again, I'm fine with that. I can see that why people were really upset about this executive order. And somebody, and she's, the reporter's saying to her, okay, but did you know that, you know, President Obama also for a period was limiting, you know, had a complete ban on immigrants from, and I think she was trying to say Iraq, and the woman misunderstood her and said Iran, but, and she puts the mic in front of her face and the woman actually says, oh no, but I liked Obama. You know, I supported him. I wish we had him back here. You know, and which is completely missing the whole point that, you know, did you, so anyway, that's the kind of thing I mean where it's not, you know, if these protesters were saying, wow, now we see the light with this guy we despise in the White House. Now we see the problem with federal power and, you know, in the future, let's just be more circumspect before we blindly follow some new leader because he's given us health insurance or the goodies we like, you know, I would be all for that, you know, and I wouldn't bring up past errors or anything like that, but I'm concerned a lot of people flipping out about Trump. It's not that they object to having a powerful person in the White House. It's they object to having a powerful person in the White House who isn't going to implement the agenda they want. All right, so that was a very long, brief comment. I'm sorry, I had to get that off my chest. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. That's okay. You know, it's very similar to what he's doing with the Department of Labor ruling. I mean, on this particular ban, it was for a period of 120 days, and the countries were Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan and Yemen. Now, it's true, I am an immigrant, Bob, but my goodness, I came over in 1954. So I was like 6 years old. I think my parents said it took about almost 3.5 years to prepare the paperwork just to come over from Mexico to the United States. It was a very, very long process to do that. And of course, we had a different America back then too. But my feelings about this is, it's really hard to believe that a judge in this just one jurisdiction, you know, can shut down an entire government, you know, operation, you know, put out by the president. But that's what he did in effect, you know. And it just goes to show, you know, which is interesting because Trump is basically doing what he said he was going to do and what he got it voted in for. I mean, there's a bunch of people that were, you know, really liking that he was going to do this sort of thing. So it's funny how politics works, you know. This ban to me is just the president trying to deliver on what he's thinking everybody wanted. That's why he's president. They voted for him to do this sort of thing. But then I do see that there were like 97 companies that you know did file a lawsuit, you know, all having to do with this ban, and most of them were technology companies primarily. And it's a bunch of the big ones like Apple and Google and Facebook, Intel, Netflix. I mean, it's like the who's who of Silicon Valley. So it just, you know, and their position was that all this was going to hurt economically. And so, you know, everybody's expressing their sides here. And I don't know if it'll make it to the Supreme Court or not, but it's an interesting twist here to all of this, as far as I'm concerned, almost difficult to believe.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not enough of a legal scholar to know the ins and outs. So, I mean, in general, just because a president or a candidate says, hey, I'm going to do something, and then gets elected and goes and does it. I mean, if what the person's trying to do is unconstitutional and the Supreme Court says you can't do that, or, you know, a federal judge or somebody says you can't do that. I mean, that is how the system's supposed to work, that it's, you know, not merely what does the majority want to protect the rights of the minority. But it is, again, how this is being characterized, where it is a temporary ban to, you know, just review procedures. And that's partly what I would look at, you know, when I'm, because clearly what's going on here, let's not be coy. The people who are against Trump think that this is like the early stages of Nazi Germany, you know, where, well, in the beginning, they didn't just all of a sudden send people to camps. There were like intermediate stages. And man, we look back and say, why didn't the Germans stand up and resist? Right. And so you can see how people right now who despise Trump, they think that's what this is. And they're like, what are you guys doing? You know, what does he need to do before you, you know, wake up and see it? Whereas, you know, the defenders are saying, what are you talking about? It's not a ban on all Muslims. It's a ban on these particular countries, which, again, were singled out under the Obama administration, you know, not for this outcome, but that they were singled out this way. And it's a temporary thing while they review the procedures. So for me, one obvious thing would be to see, you know, do they keep extending the ban indefinitely and say, oh, actually, we haven't determined the procedures yet and we need more time? Because then, you know, that would roll into, you know, a de facto permanent thing. Or is it really just, you know, they want to assess things? And it is, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of just the impact, I just, can you imagine somebody who actually, you know, had approval from the U.S. government to come here and work, and they're literally on the plane, and then the rules change, and they land and say, oh, you can't come in? I mean, so that's, in terms of just bureaucracy, and I understand the argument Trump was saying, well, we didn't want to communicate what we were going to do because then people would try to hurry up and come in. So I understand why they just did it, you know, is it effective immediately kind of thing. But in terms of just government and the political system messing with people's trying to do their lives individually and just work with these rules, it was pretty disruptive. I can certainly see why people were so shocked by it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, so far for what I'm seeing here is Trump, typical Trump, you know, moving into action. But as you read into what he's doing in these things, it's almost like he's testing the waters to see what the reaction is going to be. Now, the same thing is going on with him, you know, talking all through the campaign that he was going to tear up the Dodd-Frank Act. And of course, that one's a little closer to me because I actually read that act and I discovered some things about it. But once again, he's not tearing it up, even though he kept saying that during the campaign. What he's doing again, he's sending in, you know, his main guys here. Again, this guy, Newmick, the Secretary of the Treasury, and this fella, Gary Cohen, who apparently is some sort of the head of the White House Economic Council, to look into the Dodd-Frank Act, and he's calling for a review of it. All right, so, you know, Donald Trump is approaching the Dodd-Frank Act in the same way I'm seeing him approach these other things that are so controversial right now. He's almost like he's testing the waters. But he has been concerned and is concerned that the Dodd-Frank Act is too, you know, restrictive to the banks, and it's prevented the banks from, you know, being able to lend money to small business owners. And it's putting in a lot of costly pressures on banks, especially when it comes to, you know, building up their reserves. He's thinking that you know, it's not necessary to do those kinds of things. But we got to remember that the Dodd-Frank Act was put in place right after the financial crisis. And a whole lot of what the Dodd-Frank has in it, they call it a Consumer Protection Act. So again, it was, you know, it comes off with an appearance that it's supposed to protect the investor. But what was going on there is that everybody had fled the investment markets after the crash in 2008. So they came up with this Dodd-Frank Act ruling in order to lure the investor back into the markets. And as I read more deeply into the act, I discovered that they had a way to deal with the systemic risk of banks in such a way that it could present a real problem for just plain old bank depositors and commercial banks. So these are some of the things that I was seeing that were really bad about the act. Trump is more interested in making sure that, you know, banks are free, you know, to interact with business, and he wants them to lend money and not be so constrictive about that. And so he's doing an overhaul, not an overhaul. He's doing a review to see if he needs to overhaul the Dodd-Frank Act. And but the thing that troubles me about this, Bob, is and it's not that he should be using dumb guys to do this, but both in the case of Newmick and this guy Cohen, these are both ex Goldman Sachs guys. I mean, one of them used to be a president of Goldman Sachs. He used to be the chief operating officer of Goldman Sachs, and the other one used to be a former partner. And he's also a hedge fund manager. So I can see the banking community, the big banks, really not being frightened away by what Donald Trump is attempting to do here. In fact, I would see them encouraging it. Apparently, there's a lot of emphasis on this review being placed on the Volcker Rule. And now the Volcker Rule, that comes from a past chairman of the Federal Reserve, Volcker, this place limits on commercial banks and the whole banking industry, you know, getting involved with speculative bets. And so the Volcker Rule, you know, just more or less stopped that. And so the Dodd-Frank Act was due to bring back the Volcker Rule this year. And this is the one thing that the big banks hated. They wanted that Volcker Rule reduced eliminated. And it appears as though this is where this major investigation of the Dodd-Frank Act is really going to be centered on, whether they should remove that particular ruling out of it, which, in my opinion, is one of the more dangerous things about the whole thing. So I can see that the people involved in looking into this review are the big are guys that came from Goldman Sachs. You know, they're all big bank people, and so it's really hard to know how this will play out. But from what I see so far, this may not be the very best thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's this stuff gets really nuanced. So as far as the Volcker rule, I mean, I don't know that I haven't studied it enough to know whether I have a particular position. In general, the way I handle this kind of stuff is to say, look, there's different regimes the government could use with regard to the banking system. My preferred one is that it's laissez-faire. You know, just contract enforcement. And so if, you know, banks take people's money and they make promises and then you say, hey, your money's always here. If you want to show up and withdraw it, go ahead and do that. And then the banks go and invest the funds in something really speculative and it blows up in their face. And then the people want their money and they don't have it. Okay, well, the bank goes out of business then. You shut it down. And that's it. End of story. And, you know, the people get their money back based on normal bankruptcy procedures. Another option would be, the government says, okay, the taxpayer is going to be on the hook. We're going to insure bank deposits because we don't want to live in a world where you could lose all your funds just because the bank made a bad investment. But then because of that, we're going to then put strict limits on what, you know, the financial institution or depository institutions can do with those funds because we don't want to, you know, be subsidizing your profits. And then if there's losses, then the taxpayer eats it. I don't like that, but there's a certain rationale. What's kind of crazy is a system where the government says, yes, these deposits are insured, and or even if they're not explicitly insured legally, but kind of everybody knows, you know, things that are too big to fail are going to be bailed out either through the Fed or, you know, through the Treasury somehow. And the people who run those institutions are allowed to go and do whatever they want with the money and pay themselves huge bonuses if it turns out okay. But then if it blows up in their face, you know, they don't have to face the music as much because we'll come in and ultimately cushion the blow. And so, you know, in that kind of a context, it is hard to know, you know, if the government's going to roll back a particular regulation that limits what financial institutions can do with their funds. It's hard to evaluate that from a libertarian perspective or, you know, just a general free market economist perspective, because it's already in this weird system where there's these implicit guarantees and bailouts and so on that are waiting in the wings. And a similar thing, too, with the Goldman Sachs stuff. I mean, it is tricky if you're going to be in charge of this stuff and trying to roll it back. You do need people involved who have industry experience. Right. Like just like if the FDA is going to start putting out regulations regarding pharmaceuticals, you wouldn't want to have these new regulations go out without anybody from the industry giving any kind of feedback, you know, because it's possible that the people are just insane and they have no idea how burdensome this particular regulation is going to be. Or if, the EPA or somebody, a Department of Energy they're going to put out new regulations that regulate automobile emissions or things like that. You know, you want to have industry have some chance to give feedback to say, whoa, you know, that's look at what you're talking about here. Look at what the impact would be on the price of a car if you put this kind of regulation in place. So, yes, in those situations, it's a similar kind of thing where obviously there's a danger that what's going to be called the regulators are going to be captured by industry and there's going to be a revolving door. Clearly, that's a worry. That's a danger. But on the other hand, you know, it's that I don't know. It doesn't mean, OK, I want the government to be staffed and these agencies to be staffed by people who have just been bureaucrats their whole lives either. So it's hard. You know, again, it's a bad situation when the government is heavily involved. There's really no good options to unravel this thing, that you're always going to end up making mistakes because the point was that it shouldn't have gotten so heavily involved in the first place. So that's not me by any stretch defending Trump's particular personnel choices. I'm just saying that it's, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury, you probably don't want it to be some guy who has been in politics his whole life either. That I don't think that would be great either. Well, I think, Carlos, maybe at this point we've talked about specifics. Do you want to just give everybody our sort of, at this point, what our overall gut feel is on things and wrap it up at this point? I know you were talking about the VIX to me earlier before the show started. You want to maybe explain to people that particular issue?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. Well, again, you know, just as far as a recap goes on what we've been talking about, once again, if my particular view of it is that it's kind of hard to know how any of this is going to play out still. You know, Trump is a weird guy. He really is. And but I do see him in all of these cases more or less just testing the water out and see what he's going to find once he does his own study here. Oh, and regarding the VIX, Bob, it was something that I was reading here. I guess it was yesterday or today. I can't even remember now. But there are a lot of people that are thinking that nobody seems to be worried about the stock market crashing. And the piece that I was reading was talking about that the VIX indicator was really low. And at the same time, we've got record highs in the stock market. And, you know, before the elections, you know, most pundits were starting to, you know, feel like everything was poised to crash, no matter who came into office. And then all of a sudden, you know, Trump was elected and stock market rose even higher. And so the question comes up, is anybody worried that the stock market might still crash? And of course, you know, our feelings are is that it still will. We just don't know exactly when. That we've been saying all along, it didn't matter who came into office. They're not going to fix the problems that the Fed has created. I mean, there's no way they can come out of it except through a real major correction. But the piece that I was reading by was that they were saying that people in the markets have really been buying what is calling plunge protection, meaning they're not selling out, but they're buying an enormous amount of puts on all their holdings, and the cost of this plunge protection is going up in price, but they're willing to pay the price because, you know, deep down inside, they know it's going to come down and they're just trying to protect themselves.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's interesting. And we should perhaps in future issues of the Lara Murphy report, we can dive into that in more detail. And that you're largely echoing my view that, as we've been saying for a long time, since Ben Bernanke started doing all the rounds of quantitative easing, we think that that's he's blown up an unsustainable bubble. And Trump coming in and having what I think clearly compared to Hillary Clinton administration, I think the stuff that the Trump administration is doing economically, I'm not talking about on other areas, but in terms of just economic, you know, taxation and regulation, I think is clearly better than what a Hillary Clinton administration would have been. And arguably isn't so bad overall, even in an absolute sense. You know, even if they do a lot of things regulating international trade, which I'm going to be against, but if they couple that with significant tax relief on other areas, maybe on balance, that's not going to be so awful. You know, again, all this stuff, it remains to be seen. What do they actually do? But nonetheless, even if they did have great tax reform, even if they do have great constraints put on government spending growth and free up regulations on businesses in ways that make sense, that's not going to change the fact that interest rates have been way too low for years, leading to a bunch of male investments in the Austrian sense of that term. And so I think no matter what, you're still going to have a major downturn. And the issue is just how painful and long will the crisis and recovery be if the Trump team gets decent policies in place by that point. Then it doesn't have to be an awful, agonizing 4 or 5 years of a lackluster recovery. It could be a pretty quick bounce back. But again, I think Carlos and I are still standing by the fundamental analysis we've been putting out all these years, saying that very low, artificially low interest rates are not a help for the economy. They're just setting us up for a crash. Any other thoughts, Carlos, or should we let people go after this fairly long episode?
I think we could stop here.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we will catch you next time. We'll have some links at the show notes page for this episode if you want to have some further reading. So, again, this was episode 34 of The Laura Murphy Show. Hope to catch you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not here and engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.